Voices at dusk. The light is waning and dusk has all of a sudden vanished into night. The island is hushed. Inside the guest house, Lucy, Nerea and I sit together on the floor of the blush-toned living room, beginning tentatively to sing fragments from the three-voice score for Mary Smith from Lewis, who will be helping to correct our Gaelic pronunciation. Mary sits in an armchair, her back straight and her face gentle, listening carefully as we work through the composition. When we sing a phrase that does not sound quite right, she smiles, stops us with a "no," and then sings the correct version back to us. We try again, imitating her pronunciation, and until we get it right, this call and response continues, broken only by laughter and our occasional sounds of frustration. As singers without Gaelic, certain sounds are particularly difficult for us. It's as if our ears and tongues aren't yet tuned in to the subtle nuances of the language. Take the various L sounds. Here in this extract, we're trying to get the phrase correct.
No, it's wrong, L. Factor L. Touch your teeth with the tip of your tongue.
For Lucy, Nerea and I, this is such an unusual way to come to a language, for we're not immediately focusing on meaning, but on the actual sounds. It's all very different from the familiar process of learning conversational phrases, such as, "Hello, my name is," "Can you tell me the way to," and so on. And I can't help thinking that learning a language in this way is a little like learning to speak bird. After all, I once heard it said that Gaelic was the original language of the birds. I ask Mary why she thinks people come to learn Gaelic as adults. Is it to do with identity? "Yes, I think so," she says, and continues to explain how, as a child, she was forced to learn English at school. This education policy imposed on the islands from the mainland meant that children were no longer taught in their mother tongue, and so individuals, and in some cases whole communities, lost their fluency in their native tongue. For some folk who have their roots in the Western Isles, learning Gaelic is a way to reclaim and reconnect with something that has been lost, and through this, perhaps they find it possible to foster a closer relationship with the landscape, culture and values that nurtured the language. After our evening lesson in Gaelic pronunciation, Lucy and Nerea go to see the others who have been chatting and cooking in the kitchen. I find a cushion on the floor and make myself comfortable next to Mary. We decide to look together at the songs and poems that I've not yet worked with in the final composition. We begin with the song thrush, or smeoroch, in Gaelic, listening to one of Jeff's recordings of the bird, and then to a recording made by John Long Campbell of Annie Johnston on Barra, reciting the poem in 1938.
Vodevic, Regina, Regina, Aran Kruoy Kuskiri Kotskis, Mewklish, Mewklish. Я не стиле воде викика, хайкика, хайкатучи, катучи, котхиня, котхиня. Кочеджина, кочеджина. Аран Круоy Kuskiri Kotskis, Mewklish, Mewklish.
This wonderfully animated poem imitates the playful and intricate couplet style and rhythms of the bird's melody. Mary tells me that to really evoke this songster, the poem needs to be spoken quickly. She begins and I follow her, doing my best to keep up. But because of the speed the lick of our tongues have to move at, I find some of the pronunciation difficult, in truth, almost impossible. After much laughter, Mary encourages me to bob up and down like a bird while I say the rhyme. I experiment with this technique, and sure enough, it does help. Once I've caught the sound, I then try to say it without the movement.
Can
you say vo?
Ian ikile vodevik.
Vode.
Vode, Mary.
Ian ikile
vodevik. Like the Virgin Mary.
Ian
ikile vodevik.
Ian ikile vodevik.
Vik.
Vik.
Vik. Vik.
Ian ikile vodevik. Ian ikile vodevik.
That's it.
Ian ikile vodevik. Ian ikile vodevik. Ian ikile vodevik.
Ian ikile vodevik.
Ian ikile vodevik. Ian ikile vodevik.
Ian ikile vodevik.
Yeah, can you do it without bobbing?
Because people will laugh at you.
Well, because they don't already.
We move on to discuss the swan songs, of which there are many variations that use similar sounding vocables, some more swan-like than others, but all with slightly varying melodies or words. For example, Kuliki, Kuliko, Kuliki, Kuliko. And Kuviki, Kuviko, Kuviki, Kuviko. Jeff thinks that all these vocables imitate the sounds of a particular species of swan, the hooper swan. I tell Mary that I intend to compose something that breaks up the rhythm of the vocables with overlapping voices, relating the sounds in the songs back to the sounds of the swans. We listen to Jeff's recording made by Almore Loch in the Borders. The sound reverberates across the water. I'm particularly intrigued by a version sung by Annie Arnott on Sky, a recording made in 1954 by Callum McLean. The song begins with a verse. Which means, voice of the raven, voice of the bird, voice of the raven, voice of the bird, voice of the swan across the marsh, voice of the raven, voice of the bird, voice of the swan across the marsh. It then moves on to a section composed entirely of vocables, keeping the same melody and then ending with a line repeated from earlier on in the song.
Kuviki, hello, son, Lord. Go on ye, go on ye, go on hello, son, Lord.
Though not particularly swan-like, the sound of these vocables does bear a striking resemblance to the lyrics earlier in the song. Specifically, the gu fragment of the vocable has a sound very close to the word gu, which means voice. Could the composer or composers of the song be enjoying the play on words and suggesting the intimacy of connection between our voices and the songs and language of the birds? And does this in turn suggest that these songs have grown out of a culture that was tuned into a common register, one which sets, sees, hears, sings and feels human beings in reciprocal relationship to the animate landscape? Mary says that swans are interesting birds because they were thought to have particular gifts. Then she shares a story. When I was in South Uist, there was a man who had this fixation about swans. I remember one time he went to the swan nest and he took the eggs and he smashed them on the road. And we all thought, how weird is that? Goodness knows why he did it. It is something that normal people wouldn't do. We were all horrified. Horrified by the waste. I mean, people ate swan's eggs. They made use of them for gigantic omelettes, but he just smashed them in the road. But then, there was an island in Bornish which is by the sea, and the swans had their nest there. And this man was drowned swimming to that island. It was as if the swans were wreaking their revenge on him for messing with their eggs. It was as if they had some kind of power, which people believed, and they still believe today. The old belief that swans are magical has been documented by folklorists and historians. In Ireland, it was believed that the souls of people became embodied in swans. On Uist, the naturalist Gray was told by an old woman that a wounded swan, which was heard uttering melancholic cries on Loch Bee, was the ghost of her grandmother. Writing in 1716, Martin Martin records that in the Hebrides it was considered unlucky to kill a swan. And in Carmina Gadelica, Alexander Carmichael writes, "In windy, snowy or wet weather, swans fly low. But in calm, bright or frosty weather, they fly high. But even when the birds are only specks in the distant blue light above, their soft, silvery, flute-like notes penetrate to earth below." Swans are said to be ill-used religious ladies under enchantment, driven from their homes and forced to wander, and to dwell where most kindly treated and where least molested. They are therefore regarded with loving pity and veneration, and the man who would injure a swan would thereby hurt the feelings of the community. Talking with Mary, I realised that these songs not only help us to glimpse into the culture, beliefs and practices of ancient peoples, they also offer an insight into the psychology of our own time.